Klugman is terrific. Klugman is dynamite. Klugman is Klugman.
The lion is strong and the man is weak, and the world walks in between. Surround above on the wings of love. See and let yourself be seen.
It's all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey. But God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem, but one day God's preacher must talk about the New New York, the New Atlanta, the new Philadelphia, the new Los Angeles. We don't need any bricks and bottles. We don't need any Molotov cocktails. We just need to go around to these stores and to these massive industries in our country and say, God sent us by here to say to you that you're not treating his children right. And we come by here to ask you to make the first item on your agenda fair treatment where God's children are concerned. Now, if you are not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you.
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman, back from L.A., back from the Norman Goldman Show. I just want to thank all of Norm's listeners and anybody from Norm's listeners who's listening to me today. Thank you. Thank you to all of my listeners for listening to me today. I told you I was going to go meta on the monologue. I did. We got some calls on it. I'm almost afraid to pick it up. Linda in McMinnville, welcome to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. What's up?
Well, for one thing, the innocence thing, I just had a conversation with somebody about that 2 days ago, which is a meta thing, because that's pretty weird.
It is?
And weird, okay. And weird means supernatural. But what I really called about is similar, but one thing is people say that they're sometimes I'm only human, and then other times we say I'm just a human being.
Uh-huh.
And I say that there are both humans and human beings on Earth, and that is the problem. I'm a human being, and I think so are you.
I think so, and I think humans are cool, and I think my fantasy is that what we launch is a human potential movement.
No,
you say no.
Humans are Homo sapiens, and we've evolved into Homo sapiens sapiens, which is the human being. So what I'm saying is people like Rush Limbaugh and them have not evolved into a human being. They probably were marked for extinction 2,000 to 5,000 years ago. But it's hard to explain. But if you separate the beingness from the human part of us, you can see that everything that they do is just about survival, which is what our human part does.
Well, I hear you, the distinction, Linda, and I appreciate the call. My point is that even Rush Limbaugh is a human being, that we don't make those kinds of distinctions, because there aren't some of us that are better human beings than other, because what is essentially human about us is unlimited. That to say I'm just a human being is like saying I'm just a miracle. I'm just an unlimited potential waiting to happen. I mean, that's the meta of what I'm talking about. We're going to go to break because my monologue went long. We will be right back. You're listening to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman on AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's talk station. Good to be back. We're going to take all your calls. It's just you and me this first hour. We'll be right back.
This is Mad as Hell in America, Portland's progressive talk, 620 KPOJ.
Welcome back. to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's smart talk station. I just went out of my mind. I had a great time doing it. Let's go right to calls. We got a full board. Alex from nowhere. Welcome to Mad as Hell in America. What's up, Alex?
Hey, it's actually Alex.
Alex, yeah.
Alex, but I really liked what you had to say. I agreed with everything. And
thanks.
At the very end, I thought you almost sounded like the Dalai Lama, and it really made my day because it's so easy to be mad at all the clowns of the world. And if you just, what you said to try for an hour, it just made me feel so much better, just letting go of everything I'm feeling about a lot of people in the world in the past and now, and I just liked what you had to say.
Right on, Alex. Thanks so much for the call. So what Alex is referring to, I appreciate it. I asked people that when the guilt of the world comes at you, you know, when the Herman Cains and the Newt Gingriches and the Democrats betray you and the whole system is just completely out of its flipping mind, what you do is just release it. You don't see its guilt. You don't agree with it. You don't nod and What you do is you just release it. You know, you believe that our mission here is to bring our innocence forward. Like, from that, everything we need will come. It's like it's spiritual politics. Like, that's my fundamental kind of orientation, is like a politics of love. That's what I work for. That's what I think about. Sometimes it makes me feel insane, and sometimes it makes me feel relieved. So try it for an hour when you're watching TV. Don't buy it. Just release it. Just let it go. Let's go to Don in Albany. Don, welcome to Mad as Hell in America.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
All right, Don. How's it going?
Doing good. Doing good. Unless I'm mistaken, I think Gene Roddenberry was trying to say pretty much the same thing through Star Trek, that more enlightened times are coming.
They are coming.
Yes. Something tells me we humans will make it through this period of total insanity and actually grow up in spite of ourselves.
I think we will. Don, yeah. Don, I think you're right. And I think that think about your own personal life, right?
I know. I think we're already seeing the first glimmerings of it by considering who's president.
Well, there you go. I mean, I've got some issues with this president's behavior, but I will refuse to see him as guilty. I refuse to make it personal. And I think,
a door's been opened that can never be closed again. Am I right or wrong?
No, that's right. Well, that's one good way of looking at it, Don. That's what I'm talking about. Thanks for the call. Yeah, that's the idea, that we hold people accountable to their actions, but we do not perceive their guilt. We do not perceive guilt in the world. There is already so much of that, and all we do is compound it. And what we really end up doing is just making ourselves more cynical and affirming our own guilt. And that's not going to lead us to solution. That is the mind that created the problems, this inherent guilt that we find at the core of lots of organized religions, that we're guilty sinners and we're bad and we're screwed up. Well, we have to stop believing that. We have to stop asserting with it, and we have to stop agreeing with it. That's, I think, the key. That's the meta view for the first hour of Mad as Hell. Not so mad as hell. Jan in Mount Hood, welcome to Mad as Hell in America. You're on.
Wow, what a beautiful perspective. I want to give a shout out to you.
Thank you.
Because I like what the idea that you connect your mind and your heart before you're using your voice.
Right.
And the Northwest is so great. I just got back from the Hanging Chad Land down Alligator Alley, helping my mom out. She's turning 95, and I thought the way the Buddhists would say that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, that we really got it going on here, thanks to people like you that are in this human revolution movement where we can move the chariot along together. And I think your attunement is sublime. I do a lot of meditative, active practice in Buddhism, chanting Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, because if we can really hone in on the correct teaching on how we can advance together by treating each other in a kind way and creating value with our lives, it's like amazing to find clear-minded people that can support each other and not just dog each other to death.
There you go. I couldn't agree more, Jan.
You're spot on.
Thanks, Jan. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. I'm going to go to Sean in Battleground, who thinks I'm naive. Go ahead, Sean. Lay it on me, brother.
Adam, in the words of my favorite Marxist political scientist, Michael Parenti, he would say there's a lot of what he called goo-goo gaga baby-type thinking going on right now. There's a lot of naivete. How did people respond in the 1930s in the first Great Depression? Did they hide in Eastern religions? Did they wallow in this kind of silly idealism? No, they went out and they became revolutionaries. They formed the Communist Party USA. That's what led to the pressure that created the civil rights movement, that created the labor movement, that pressured the mainstream political parties to finally start some minor reforms. And why do we think we're so much more intelligent or so much more enlightened than the people back in the 1930s? We saw what worked in the 30s. We need to go back to that today.
Well, Sean, I appreciate what you're saying. I don't think that what I'm putting out, and I think I was clear in the monologue, is mutually exclusive of taking direct political action. What I'm trying to identify is the spirit with which we go out. We don't go out and get politically active because we hate what is. We do it because we know what could be. And I'm out there. I'm not sitting in my home meditating going, oh, I'm going to change the world. I'm saying that we want to change the spirit and the perception that we use when we go out and do exactly what they did in the 30s, which is apply pressure to the democracy so that it functions like a healthy democracy, to apply pressure to the justice system so that it's capable of achieving justice. I'm not talking about mutually exclusive endeavors, and this is what I think, and this I take from Gandhi's whole point of view, which was he didn't go out and see the guilt of his oppressor. What he did was try to draw out the humanity in its oppressor, and I think that that's what I'm talking about. And you know, it's easy to call it goo goo gaga, and that's why it was a risk for me to put it out. But I'm not going to betray it, because I think that is the spirit that we need, that we don't need to go out in the spirit of attack and guilt. I don't think that's going to lead to any lasting change. It's like that, then the power just flips, and then the old boss becomes the new boss, looks just like the old boss. That's my rap.
Would you at least concede that Gandhi and Martin Luther King wouldn't have gotten anywhere if it weren't for the existence of the Soviet Union in the background? The establishment was terrified that Indians were going to turn to communism. They were terrified that people in this country were going to turn to communism. The only reason the nonviolent movements got anywhere was the existence of the Soviet Union looming in the background. And is it any coincidence that since the fall of the Soviet Union, the attack on working class and poor people has only accelerated year after year? And you have the privilege of having this show every weekend. And if you really want to change things, invite Marxists on your show. Talk about Marx. Use this platform to talk about Marxism. That's what improved the world in the past. I want to hear more Marxists on your show.
All right. You got a deal.
Thanks, Adam.
All right, Sean, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. You know, people disagree on these things. That's what it's about. If you want to join the conversation, if you agree with Sean, think this is just a lot of goo goo gaga talk that leads nowhere, I happen to fundamentally disagree, but I do think that Marx had some good points. I don't think that Marx had the full solution, but I will explore it as fully as I explored this perspective. 503-248-0620, 1-866-452-0620. Let's go to Mike in Kelso. Mike, welcome to Mad as Hell in America. You're on with Adam Klugman.
Oh, I want to say congratulations on that, your opening gambit there. It hits the nail right on the head.
Well, thanks, Mike.
I think a lot of people make a mistake, and we lose sight of our goals and the main goal that we're out there. And instead of this anger, we should look at these injustices with a view from sadness that these injustices are taking place.
Mm. Yeah.
And another thing is, I think people forget, I am for the occupation movement, but people forget, like when Gandhi... One of the main reasons Gandhi was so successful was the people of India had stopped cooperating with the British powers.
That's right. They stopped cooperating with the powers, but they didn't. But they ultimately, their success was in the nonviolent, non-cooperative approach that they took. And this is what we will not achieve. This is where I fundamentally disagree with Sean. That yes, the system is screwed up, but there's lots of screwed up. There was lots of communist countries where the system is screwed up. There is no system that suddenly ameliorates human frailty and weakness and hubris. So we have to address that human to human. We have to address that by holding a different thought about who we are and who our fellow humans are and who the people are that we share this planet with. And I'm tired of guilt. I'm tired of watching TV and going, what a jerk, what a a-hole, what a this, what a that. I'm tired of all the attack. I want to start to envision the world as it is possible. And tired of just receiving and affirming the world the way it is. Mike, thanks for the call. I really do appreciate it. Let's go to Ed in Lake Oswego. Ed, welcome to Mad as Hell on America with Adam Klugman. You're on.
Hey, you know, this is a theme that you brought up time and again. I truly agree with you on it. One of the things that separates us from the other side, and I think it's important to separate ourselves, is that we care about others. We're empathetic. We see that we rise and others rise around us. And some people are too selfish. They're too self-indulgent. They don't care about others, and they just lack empathy, the human heart. But I think it's important to point a finger at them and say, you don't care. Hopefully we'll motivate them to do the right thing, but we'll elect people that care about us. I don't know if you heard that Susan Collins now said, oh, we can't pass the extension of the tax break for people on the payroll tax because we can't pay for it. And on the other hand, she gave trillions of dollars to rich Americans. I find that heartless.
Yeah, it is heartless, and we need to call it out.
Yeah.
I don't think that this perspective that I'm putting forth somehow excludes accountability.
No.
I think it actually makes accountability possible, because by shining the light of what you're saying on the idea that you're heartless, that you're without compassion,
yes,
and that if we're not building a society that is compassionate, empathetic,
yeah,
then we're building a society that's doomed.
Absolutely.
Because these are the fundamental moral laws of the universe that I think we live in. And I don't think Marx created his system of thought outside a natural system. I think he was trying, from my readings, trying to bring human systems in accord with natural systems where there is equity. And
yep,
some of his thoughts failed, and some of them were absolutely brilliant. So I'm going to have some marks on just to satisfy
Good.
Sean.
Great.
Ed, thanks so much.
Sure.
You're listening to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. The numbers here are 503-248-0620, 1-866-452-0620. We have one more segment left to continue this conversation. If you want to join in, I'm here. 503-248-0620, 1-866-452-0620. We are having a meta conversation. Do you agree with Sean? Am I full of it? Is this just a lot of spiritual wankery? Sometimes I don't know myself. I do appreciate all the calls. Thank you all much. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's smart talk station. And we do have some smart listeners. I went out on a limb. If you want to send me an email on this and you're shy about calling in, send it to adam@madashellinamerica.com. You can also join us at Facebook. Type in Mad as Hell in America. And Sean, send me a couple of guests on Marxism. I'd be glad to have it. I'm an open-minded guy. I believe it's all possible. My job isn't to make people feel comfortable and affirmed so we have a circular firing squad of a conversation. My job is to push. And push myself and push you and push the conversation beyond the circular firing squad. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Eddie in Sandy. Eddie, welcome to Mad as Hell in America. You're on, man.
Hi, Adam. Really love listening to your show today, and I'd like to say hello to my friend Jan. I just heard her on.
Oh, okay.
Fellow Buddhist, and I completely agree with about letting go, but I also want to say that being angry and being mad also has its benefits, because if you understand how to channel your anger and take action in these things that make us so angry, we can tackle some huge problems that we have in this nation, and also have compassion for our fellow human beings, even the ones we don't really like.
Absolutely. What we're mad about is injustice. That's the point. We don't move into rage and say, okay, we're going to destroy the object of our anger. But what we do is we listen to our anger. I totally agree. I think that legitimate human anger is the only thing that's ever really changed the world. Gandhi was mad as hell at the English. Being mad as hell is an appropriate response to being treated like a second-class citizen. We don't give that up. It's that we don't carry the thought form of guilt as we go forward. What we do is we hold the other in the highest possible esteem, and we do not cooperate. Eddie, thanks so much for the call, man. He's gone. Eddie, let's go to Virginia in Portland. Virginia, welcome to Mad as Hell in America. You're on with Adam Klugman.
You're absolutely right. There is nothing, no force on the planet more powerful than love.
I think it's a political force.
And I think it's in the air right now. I mean, people are hearing the same stuff. They're all, you know, they're getting on the same page. But if you look back, the people that have most influenced history over a long period of time, Jesus, Gandhi, Bonhoeffer, King, are people whose driving force was love and were willing to surrender their biological spacesuits in that pursuit.
I dig it. And you know, if people are squeamish about it, and thanks for the call, Virginia, you know, if people are squeamish about it, then let's get unsqueamish, you know? I mean, I get where Sean is at. He's a really bright guy. He calls the show all the time, and I love his conversations, and I'm thrilled he called and pushed back as hard as he did, because you see the way he did it? He spoke, and then I listened, and then he listened to me, and we had an exchange, and we got somewhere. Because he doesn't see me as guilty, even though he thinks I'm just full of it today. That's cool. That's today. But he doesn't hold me as guilty. So he's doing it. And this is where we start. And then we have conversations about the kinds of actions and the non-cooperative statements that we make with a system that is sick and making us sicker. Let's go to Deborah in Beaverton. Deborah, welcome to Mad as Hell in America. You're on.
Hey there. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you beautifully.
All right. Yeah, unfortunately, I did not hear your monologue, but
okay.
Picking up on the tone of the conversation, I can't tell you, it just gave me a breath of fresh air because I feel so lost sometimes because I am at the point in my life at 53 years old where I want to live in the world that you talk about. And
right.
I sometimes get so frustrated that I don't know how to get there, you know, and I'm a conflict consultant, and my master's degree is in conflict analysis. And it's such a the idea of conflict is such a really a simple idea. It's really, you know, the time and space where differences come together, and it's how do you approach those differences? You know, do you out of fear perceive them as threatening and react on that, or do you embrace with curiosity and, you know, a heart of understanding and, you know, accountability? I'm all for accountability, but it's compassionate accountability. We're
right.
All human, you know. We're not perfect. We obviously we don't do everything right, but it doesn't mean, you know, we have to point the finger and somebody has to be to blame and they're the bad person, they're the villain, because that's way too easy.
Well, then we give our power away, right? We defer our power to our villains. We defer our power to our heroes when the power is right here, right in that mad as hell moment when we say, well, I'm not going to cooperate with this injustice.
Well,
and if you want to use Marxism, right? If you whatever you want to use, Deborah, I got to move on. But thanks so much for the call. I totally agree. Keep listening. Let's go to Ural in Portland. Do I have the name right, Ural?
Yeah. Thanks.
Well,
yeah. So I wanted to address the whole your approach on Gandhi. It seems to be one of those objects of history that is really whitewashed. People fail to look into India about, for instance, one individual named Bhagat Singh, who was a militant anti-imperialist at the time, was literally waging war against the occupiers. Also, to address the kind of, like, idea that love will ultimately, I guess, fix everything, it's a wonderful idea, and I love it, but at the same time, it's naive, because on the other side, We have neo-fascists, we have white nationalists, we have people that
are preparing
to murder us, like, without any pity. And here we are,
basically circle jerking the idea of love and all this stuff. It just it's a beautiful philosophical thought, but it has no basis in the pragmatic world.
I totally disagree, but I appreciate your point of view, and I think it's important that you're out there holding guys like me accountable. I appreciate it, and thanks for the call, Ural. I think it's immensely practical. I think love is the only practical thing that we have left, because we have enough hate, we have enough guilt, we have enough attack. It doesn't get us anywhere. We got time for a quick call. Paul and Tigard, chime in. You got about 30 seconds.
Yes. I believe the part in the middle that we can bring together the fella that disagreed with you and the 99ers is that the Tea Party is hungry for a message. They aren't specifically our enemy. We need to look at the big picture. And I talked 3 Tea Partiers into the 99 movement within 5 minutes.
That's,
all we need to do is communicate.
That's great, Paul. I got to run. Thanks so much for the call. Thank you, everybody, for being a part of this somewhat difficult, awkward, little too squeamish conversation, even for me sometimes. We got a great hour coming up when we come back.
Now, coming to you live from the banks of the Willamette River, it's Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman.
You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
Online at 620kvoj.com and on the air at AM 620 KVOJ.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Myth of organized society that everything that's done through the established system is legal, and that word has a powerful psychological impact. It makes people believe that there is an order to life and an order to a system, and that a person that goes through this order and is convicted has gotten all that is due him. And therefore, society can turn its conscience off and look to other things and other times. And that's the terrible thing about these past trials, is that they have this aura of legitimacy, this aura of legality. I suspect that better men than the world has known, and more of them, have gone to their death through a legal system than through all the illegalities in the history of man.
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland Smart Talk Station. And that was William Kunstler, who was the lawyer for the Chicago 8, which became the Chicago 7, talking about the aura of legality. And the reason I played that clip at the top of the hour is because that is the theme that is going to run through this hour. We have some pretty devastating legislation that's being worked through both houses in one case and through the Senate in another case, and in the House in another case. And it's all the suspension of our civil liberties taking place under the aura of legality. And we have to be very careful of this. And I think William Kunstler did an excellent job of warning us and clarifying that some of the most heinous crimes in history have been done inside the aura of legality. And so the first thing we're going to be talking about are two acts, one in the Senate called the Protect IP Act, also known as PIPA, and one recently, a more virulent version of it, called SOPA. They are Internet Piracy Protection Acts. That is the Protect IP Act in the Senate and SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act in the House. Here to help us understand this is a very smart person. His name is Parker Higgins. He is an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. Parker studied at the Gallatin School of Individualized Study at New York University, where he served as the president of its Students for Free Culture chapter. He previously lived in Berlin, working for the sound sharing platform SoundCloud, where he enjoyed the lively hacker scene in that city. Parker, welcome to Mad as Hell in America.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Have you had you ever heard that William Kunstler quote before?
You know, I haven't.
Yeah, it's a very. There's a whole documentary about him. Very interesting cat. So, the kind of the banner headline of this hour is this aura of legality. We pass laws, and then somehow there's this sense that because it's law, that it's just, and that people have gotten their due. But we have some laws that are moving through Congress as they relate to the internet. That seem pretty dangerous, that have tremendous amount of power if passed, based on accusations. So why don't you take us through these two acts, the Protect IP Act, known as PIPA, and SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, and tell us what these bills are about and where we stand with them right now.
All right. The two bills are pretty similar. There are differences between them, but it's useful to think of them as kind of two parts of the same thing. And you can see when you look at either one of them how they can be so dangerous. They're targeted, according to their proponents, at piracy sites. You know, the worst of the worst rogue websites that are based overseas and do nothing but profit from piracy of American works. But in fact, when you look at the actual language of the bill, they're written much more broadly. And these remedies that have been designed to work against the piracy sites can be used to work against any sort of site, whether it's domestic or international, and it can really have a chilling effect on these sites. And so the bills allow things like blocking at the DNS level so that the URL no longer points to the website.
So explain what you mean with that at the DNS level, because we're talking about the domain, right? Domain names?
Yeah, so DNS is short for domain name service, and it's the system that takes a URL like, say, google.com or youtube.com and connects it to the actual computer address on the other side,
right.
The IP address. And so these bills have provisions which would allow you to make it so that the URL no longer points to the computer with the website on it.
Effectively making it unsearchable, is that right?
Right. It makes it difficult for people who know the URL to go to that site. And in fact, we've seen in similar cases, they replace the website with a really ominous-looking seizure notice. So when people go to your site, and it's been seized in this case, they see these allegations that were made against you that you never got a chance to respond to.
So let's stop there for a moment, because in both SOPA, which is the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is the bill that's making its way through the House, and the PIPA, which is the Protect IP Act, which is making its way through the Senate. In both of those bills, websites can be effectively shut down based on an accusation, a kind of a somewhat secretive accusation registered with the Department of Justice, at which point the Department of Justice has the authority to shut the website down based on that accusation. Do I have it right?
Yes. And it's completely absent the sort of due process that you'd expect in a process like that.
So you never get to face your accuser. You're simply shut down.
Right. And there are procedures after that if you want to get restored. But, again, we've seen similar shutdowns of sites by the ICE. And they've done a number of seizures. And we've seen in those cases that the process of getting restored, even if you're demonstrably legal, has been difficult at best, and in some cases it appears impossible.
So let me ask you this: how necessary is this? I mean, how do companies and individuals handle copyright infringements now, and how well does it work? And obviously these are not an improvement, but is there a system in place that protects people's copyrights? I mean, they do have a right to protect their intellectual property, right?
Let's talk about how it works now.
Okay.
For the most part, it works with a law that was passed in 1998 called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. And that law says that if you find something that infringes your copyright on somebody else's site, then you have to send a formal notice, a takedown notice, they're called. And as long as that site takes down the work, then they're not liable for the infringement. So this has enabled user-generated content sites to exist. And that's sites like YouTube or like Flickr or Vimeo, they get this content from people, and in many cases they get, you know, millions of pieces of content a day. And they are allowed to offer that service because even if someone's infringing, that can be handled without a lawsuit.
How effective is that process now at protecting people's intellectual property rights?
Well, it's very effective. And in fact, not only has that been effective and has that been how user-generated content sites have worked for the past, you know, 10, 15 years, but we've also seen that that sites have volunteered to go above and beyond this. And so YouTube, to use them as an example, has developed a content identification system because it's valuable to have a good relationship with the content partners. And so in many cases, you don't even need to send the DMCA takedown notice to YouTube because they'll notify you if something that matches your copyright has been uploaded.
Our guest is Parker Higgins. He is an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. He works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org. They are doing amazing work preserving our rights and freedoms on the Internet, including lots and lots of work about net neutrality. But that is not what we are talking about today. What we are talking about today are two bills that are making their way through houses simultaneously. They are Protect IP Act, known as PIPA, moving through the Senate, and SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, making its way through the House. So one of the things that Parker Higgins, one of the things that this bill, that both of these bills also do, is hold the internet provider accountable for any copyright infringements of their users. So, for example, something that I might post on YouTube that was a copyright infringement, now somebody who has a copyright claim could make a case against YouTube. And what are the implications of this, and why is that such a devastating? By making them accomplices, what are the implications of that?
Well, many of the services that we use every day and that we love and that characterize the internet for us are dependent upon this idea of a safe harbor, that YouTube can operate like this and can offer free of charge all of these amazing tools, you know, the hosting and the player and the link that works every time. And they can do that because of the way the law works. And so to change that means that for every user of the internet, they can count on not having the same level of quality available to them, in many cases free of charge. And I think that represents an inconvenience for many of us. You know, I know that I enjoy sites that host user-generated content, but it gets really upsetting when you think about the people who depend on those user-generated content sites in order to distribute safely, you know, for example, police brutality videos or documentation of government corruption. That sort of thing really stands to be much more difficult to get out if the platforms aren't there.
Right. So all of a sudden there's all of this control that's made possible. This control is being essentially disseminated from within the Department of Justice, and we can start just shutting people down. It seems like more than a slippery slope. It seems like a leap off a cliff. So when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the political implications of this. And it seems awfully extreme, and it does bring up the conspiracy theorist in me a little bit to ask some important questions about why now. You know, just as the Occupy movement is starting to gather steam and using the internet to do so, suddenly there's this whole newfound power that wants to be accrued within the Department of Justice, and it makes me nervous. Our guest is Parker Higgins from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're talking about PIPA and SOPA. You're listening to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman on AM 620 KPOJ. We'll be right back.
Mad as Hell in America. Now on 620 KPOJ. If the sun refuses to shine,
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's smart talk station. Our guest is Parker Higgins. He is an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. Parker, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We are talking about two bills that are making their way simultaneously through both houses of our Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate. They are both designed to protect intellectual property on the Internet. They are PIPA in the Senate, which is the Protect Internet Piracy Act, right? Do I have that right? Is it the Protect Internet Piracy Act?
It's the Protect IP Act, where Protect IP stands for a very long bill name that was kind of massaged into
Protect IP. SOPA,
into a cute name.
SOPA, I know, which is the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is a slightly more virulent strain of the Protect IP Act. And I think we all agree that people have a right to protect their intellectual property on the Internet, but not at the expense of our civil liberties. And that seems to be where we're headed. So let's talk about if these bills are passed, what is the potential for abuse? And how is this like the system that China has? I mean, I think that certainly it seems to me that that's a step in the direction toward the kind of control that governments in China exert over their Internet. So let's talk a little bit about that.
I think you're correct drawing the comparison to China. There are a number of countries that have systems similar to what is being proposed, and China and Iran are some of the more prominent ones, which makes you think that maybe this isn't the right direction to be taking our Internet policy.
Right, around too.
But yeah, the possibilities for abuse of this are really devastating. You've got a system where with the Department of Justice, you can make it so that the site doesn't show up in search results and isn't available at its address. And then even without the Department of Justice, just by lodging a complaint with payment processors, you know, like PayPal sort of thing, or with the ad networks that the site uses, you can get them cut off from those sources of revenue. And in a lot of cases, these sites depend on the daily revenue in order to keep the servers running.
Well, what about WikiLeaks? I mean, how does that factor in? Isn't that kind of what they did with WikiLeaks? They just kind of cut off their access so that people couldn't make donations? I mean, isn't it at some level already in effect when we see that kind of action being taken on the Internet against WikiLeaks?
It's a very similar process to that. And in fact, at the hearing for SOPA, that was brought up as a success story, which I think is problematic in its own way. But with WikiLeaks, that was voluntary, and that was members of the government calling these companies.
Calling MasterCard, Visa, saying, look, withdraw your services from WikiLeaks, and they did, and then WikiLeaks was basically dead in the water.
Right, and that's not a good system either. I don't think that should be in place, but this represents the sort of institutionalization of that, which is not a good thing.
No, it is not a good thing. Our guest is Parker Higgins. He's an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. EFF.org is the website. Check it out. Support them. They are a nonprofit organization doing the very important work of keeping our freedoms and civil liberties alive on the Internet. They are doing tremendous work, and they depend on our support. EFF.org is the website. So there was recently a hearing, Parker, was there not? I think it was a week or so ago. And many of the people, particularly those public rights activists and consumer activists, and I think even the Consumer Electronics Association, was not allowed to testify at this hearing. Do I have it right?
Yeah. Half of the debate was silenced, was shut out of this. It was the House Judiciary Committee hearing that took place a couple of weeks ago. And they, as per usual, they invite people to sort of testify for or against the bill. And in this case, they invited five witnesses who were testifying in favor of the bill, and only one with reservations, and that was Google. And so...
And Google got hammered pretty hard, as I understand it. I mean, they went after Google pretty hard, did they not, during the hearing?
Yeah, Google was there as a pinata. and that's what you get when you invite only people in favor.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was a tough position for Google to be in.
So what can people do to stop this from happening? And first of all, what is the likelihood that these bills are going to pass either in the Senate or the House, which is probably more likely, I'm assuming, the House bill. But what is the likelihood of this passing, and what can people do to make sure that these bills don't pass?
Well, the likelihood is a little bit hard to assess. Unlike more partisan bills, both the support and opposition for each of these is pretty... broad across the ideological spectrum. And so that means that, at least for the Senate one, it could pass sort of any day now. And fortunately, Senator Ron Wyden up there is doing really great work to prevent that from being an open and shut thing. But it really does, there's a good chance of either of these passing, which is scary for the Internet. In terms of what you can do, a lot of it's just calling your senator or your congressman and letting them know that you stand in opposition. You know, they've spoken a lot to the media companies who have spent, legacy media companies spent $94 million in lobbying so far this year. And so they get a lot of FaceTime with the legislators. And to let the legislators know that this is a problem and that it abridges freedom of speech in a way that's unacceptable is actually turning the tide on this.
Well, that's good to know. I think that I heard someone brought up China and Iran as examples of where the direction that these bills take us in, and it kind of stopped it. Our guest has been Parker. Thank you so much, by the way. I really appreciate you coming on and helping clarify this. Our guest has been Parker Higgins, who is an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech, copyright, trademark, and patent law. Parker Higgins, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll have you on again as this evolves. You are listening to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. When we come back, we're going to look at another law, the National Defense Authorization Act, which recently passed out of committee a provision that essentially makes all of our continent a battlefield, authorizing the United States government to detain American citizens indefinitely if they are merely accused of terrorism. And we are going to explore that issue with our good friend David Swanson when we come back. This is Mad as Hell in America. I'm Adam Klugman.
Big government Republicans and Democrats were busy shredding the last vestiges of the Constitution. Senators John McCain and Carl Levin want to enact a law that would declare the entire United States of America a battlefield for the military. They're talking about inserting the Army into domestic law enforcement. Senator Lindsey Graham, who supports this bill, says, quote, "The homeland is part of the battlefield, and people can be held without trial, whether an American citizen or not." I guess he hasn't read the Constitution recently.
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland Smart Talk Station. That was Judge Napolitano on Fox News. And you know we're through the looking glass when I find myself agreeing with him. There is some funky stuff going on in Washington about new laws that seem to be able to incarcerate, lock, create actionable situations based on accusations. This one seems a little bit more frightening even than the SOPA Act, although, and the PIPA Acts, although it is is all pretty frightening. To help us make sense of this is our good friend and good friend of this show, David Swanson. He is the author of War is a Lie and Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. He blogs at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org. He holds a master's degree in philosophy from the University of Virginia. He has worked as a newspaper reporter and a communications director, including press secretary for Dennis Kucinich's 2004 presidential campaign. Swanson, in my estimation, is a very vocal and supremely articulate advocate for peace and one of our nation's most engaged social activists. David Swanson, welcome to Mad as Hell in America.
Great to be here again. Thanks for having me.
So let's get started. Let's get right into this. You heard Judge Napolitano. That was on Fox News. It really makes me nervous when I agree with what's going on Fox News. Does he have it right? What is going on with the National Defense Authorization Act and this provision that was recently passed out of committee, kind of secretly without any hearings, that would essentially authorize the United States government to detain Americans on their own soil without due process? Am I overstating the case? Is that the case?
You could only be understating the case by implying that such things have not yet happened, if you were implying such. No, you're not overstating anything. This is a bill that to throw another over $650 billion into wars and the military in this time of this pretended financial crisis, to extend the war in Afghanistan that the majority of us are opposed to and so forth. I mean, it's a criminal bill to begin with, the basic substance of it. Even though they passed this resolution, surprisingly enough, brought by a senator from Oregon, that encourages the president to please end it a little bit faster than 3 years from now. That was the good news. But then on the bad news side, on top of this horrendous bill, they've added this codification, this formalization of the power of the president and the military to supersede our courts and our constitutional rights and use force and imprisonment against anybody, anywhere, any place, including U.S. citizens, lock you away without any charge, any trial whatsoever, just at the accusation from the president or the military. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. And they voted down on Wednesday an amendment from Senator Udall of Colorado, which would have stripped out this language and replaced it with something that was arguably semi-horrendous on its own terms. They voted that down. And then they voted down on Thursday an amendment from Senator Feinstein of California that would have simply excluded U.S. citizens, would have said, we can do this to 95% of humanity, but not U.S. citizens. They voted that down as well. And then they put in this compromise, which didn't compromise with anybody who was opposed to this madness, that said this should not be understood as changing current law in any way whatsoever. So why you pass a law and then say it doesn't change current law is beyond me. But the problem is, of course, that it does change current written law dramatically for the worse, and the president's interpretation of existing law is even worse. And so you have this threatened veto from the president that we're in favor of and groups I work for like RootsAction.org are pushing for. But the president's motivation is probably quite different from ours in that he sees some of this as constricting the ways in which he's interpreted existing law to be even worse than what's being written down here.
So give me an example of what you mean. That's kind of a revelation to me. Well, he would vote, you're saying that the president's agenda is different than doing it based on the principle that this is against everything that our Constitution and our Bill of Rights stands for, that somehow by if he were to sign this bill, that he would already be contradicting actions that he's already taken and somehow find himself in some kind of legal trouble? Is that the implication here?
I don't know that he would find himself in legal trouble any more than he's potentially in already, and that would require that, you know, we completely reform our court system and our society, which potentially we've just begun to do with this movement that's in the streets. But this president has maintained, as has his predecessor, the right to lock people up without charge or trial. You know, it's being done on a grand scale in Bagram and elsewhere, and still in Guantanamo. You know, this Jose Padilla was an American on American soil. This is not unprecedented. The current president has already semi-formalized it as law in an executive order declaring the right to lock people up without process. But he's gone beyond that and declared he has the right to murder people without charge or trial, including U.S. citizens, and acted on it successfully and murdered a U.S. citizen without, you know, this would extend his powers explicitly to imprison, potentially by argument to murder as well, to U.S. soil. This was the exception in what he's declared for himself thus far, that he can only murder U.S. citizens when they're not on U.S. soil.
So are you referring to Anwar al-Awlaki? Is that who you mean?
Yes, indeed. That we know of. I mean, I have it on good authority that I am not empowered to cite that there have been assassinations, at least during the Bush years, if not the Obama years, of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. I cannot go into the details, so I probably shouldn't even say that. But ask yourself, you know, why the CIA is against this, why the FBI is against this. These are people who don't want this put down in writing and formalized and all put under the auspices of the military. They want to leave it open-ended with the interpretation of the 2001 authorization to use military force and the 2003 authorization to use military force, that people like John Yoo in the previous regime and now Harold Koh in this one have maintained that presidents are empowered to do just about anything to just about anybody, and it would actually limit the ability of the president and the CIA and the FBI to do things to people if this process of military trials, such as they are for everybody, were put into law. So, you know, we should be demanding that this be vetoed. The votes are there, according to the votes on these two amendments I described, to sustain a veto. The president has threatened a veto. Nothing has changed since he's repeatedly threatened it. There is absolutely no excuse not to veto this. But we should understand that the president may be vetoing it for a combination of reasons, some of which are not exactly where we're coming from.
One of the things that I found pretty shocking was, you know, okay, so John McCain was a key actor in passing this out of the committee recently, but also Carl Levin who is a Democrat, somebody who I would think knows better. And I know I'm naive, and I've been called naive all day, so I'm accustomed to it, David, but it seems to me that what is going on here? Where is this pressure coming from that you're getting somebody like Carl Levin, who knows better? John McCain, I don't give him the benefit of that doubt, but I certainly, up until now, gave it to Carl Levin. Where is the pressure coming from? Who's putting pressure on them for this?
First of all, I don't consider Carl Levin someone who you might expect better of. I consider him a murderer and a corporatist and a criminal with blood up to his shoulders. I just, you know, I don't have that same expectation. And when you look at who voted against these amendments in just enough measure to make sure that they couldn't pass and they couldn't be, you know, that a filibuster could be blocked, that you have just enough votes, as always, you know, people like Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island, who you would everyone would say, oh my goodness, why are these wonderful progressive liberal senators voting the wrong way on these things? Well, because they take turns on who's going to vote for evil things, because then they get away with it. So every senator and House member gets to vote the right way on nine things, and then they have to take their turn on the tenth one and vote the wrong way. and then they can, you know, maintain their image for the public. But they don't work for the public. They work for the party. They work for the leaders of their party. And, you know, I mean, it's not quite that simple in that now you have a disagreement between the president and the leaders of his party in the Senate. But essentially, they work for the leaders of their party and for the people who pay for their campaigns. They don't work for you and me.
Anymore.
The military is a very powerful force in Washington, D.C., as is the president. I mean, they decide where most of the jobs that the government now doles out to districts and states get placed. You know, the military is treated as a jobs program, and it's the least efficient way to create jobs known to man, you know, worse than tax cuts. But it's treated that way because it exists, and we don't do much else to create jobs. It's, you know, there's pressure from colleagues, there's pressure from the military, there's pressure from campaign funders, there's pressure from strategists who want their guy to look or woman to look tough in the corporate media. You know, there's not yet enough pressure from the rest of us.
Our guest is David Swanson. He is the author of War is a Lie and Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. He blogs at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org. David, when we come back, I want to talk about this in the context of Posse Comitatus. We'll kind of give everybody an update on what Posse Comitatus is and what the implications would be if this passed and how it would be a violation of Posse Comitatus when we come back. You're listening to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. This is AM 620 KPOJ. Our guest is David Swanson, and we are talking about the National Defense Authorization Act, which basically passed a provision out of committee which would allow the United States government to detain American citizens on American soil indefinitely and ship them off to places like Guantanamo and black prison sites all over the world without due process. More with David Swanson when we come back. Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's smart talk station. Our guest is David Swanson. He's the author of War is a Lie and Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency. He blogs at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org. David holds a master's degree in philosophy from the University of Virginia. He has worked as a newspaper reporter and as a communications director, including press secretary for Denis Kucinich's 2004 presidential campaign. Swanson is a vocal and supremely articulate advocate for peace and one of our nation's most engaged social activists. David Swanson, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks. And I'll update my bio one of these days. I have a new book.
Tell us about it.
It's called When the World Outlawed War, and it's about the peace movement of the 1920s and the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which outlawed war, and war has been illegal since 1929.
Can we buy that at davidswanson.org?
Yeah, or your local bookstore or your corporate online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever.
Reading anything by David Swanson is not going to be a waste of your time. So check it out at davidswanson.org or your local bookstore or Amazon or just anywhere where they sell books. You will find David Swanson's new book. What's the title again, David?
When the World Outlawed War.
Which is the past tense. We've got about 5 minutes left in this segment, so I want to get right to it. Talk about this, the implications of this in the context of Posse Comitatus. Tell us what Posse Comitatus is and how this would essentially, in my mind at least, do away with it.
A lot of people suggest it would repeal it. Posse Comitatus was the law put in place following the Civil War and Reconstruction that was meant to prevent the U.S. military being used, the U.S. Army anyway, being used to enforce laws at the local and state level in the United States. And there are limitations to Posse Comitatus. It's already been restricted by laws in recent years. We've had a military command of North America, NORTHCOM, for 9 years now. We've seen U.S. troops and mercenaries on our streets. We have Homeland Security, which supposedly isn't covered by Posse Comitatus, advising and training our city's police forces, as has the CIA been doing. We have, as have Israelis been doing. I mean, we've been militarizing our local police so that there's less and less distinction anyway between the way that local police behave and the way that the federal military behaves. We've also essentially federalized our National Guard. So a lot of these lines have been blurred, but this goes another big step further, at least in terms of what's down on paper. And it's shameful in the eyes of the world, and of course opposed by most Americans, and we were never shown it, and most of the Senate itself was never shown it until it was brought up for a vote.
In light of all that's kind of been going on with the Occupy movement, I find this just a little too coincidental. Is this something that you think, if passed, could actually be used against the occupation movement in this country to kind of start rounding people up and shipping them off without due process? Does it go there, and how quickly?
Well, it certainly could. There's no guarantee that it does. I mean, it's a question of what else happens in our society, in our culture, to resist this trend that's a trend that's had many, many steps in it and will have many, many more unless we reverse it. But it certainly could. And someone like Bradley Manning, who has an initial hearing next week, who's of course been held for a year already without a trial on the accusation of leaking materials that darn well needed to be leaked as a whistleblower to WikiLeaks. If the initial hearing didn't go well, then in theory they could just decide not to have a trial and just keep him locked up, and that would be in compliance with this law, as I understand it. But other cases that should arise, you could see people held on the accusation of having supported some group that supported some other group that was accused of being terrorist. We've seen disturbing trends in this direction already, and raids of peace activists and detentions of peace activists and upping of the restrictions and the arrests of protesters. I'm facing a trial myself for having spoken in a public hearing in a Senate committee. We certainly could see it go in that direction. There's no guarantee that it will, but why put this on the books? Why make it a possibility in violation of our basic constitutional rights?
That is the question that I keep asking myself, and why now? It just seems a little too coincidental. We have about a minute left, but I really want to get to this idea, because you've written extensively on the notion of an imperial presidency. Tell us very quickly what you mean by this and how this is just another example of an imperial presidency.
Well, the founders meant to give just about all the power in the government to the Congress and for the president to be an executive. And they had just fought a war to get rid of a king. They didn't want a new one. And over the years and the decades and escalating at certain stages in U.S. history, including post-World War II and including the past decade in particular, we've seen more and more power handed off from Congress to the president. And just when I mentioned that the Senate encouraged the president to consider ending the war in Afghanistan more quickly, that's not the role constitutionally. They're supposed to do it and cut off the money and tell the president what's what. This is a reversal of how it was supposed to be.
David Swanson, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Anytime. Thank you.
David Swanson is author of War is a Lie, Daybreak Undoing the Imperial Presidency, and When We Outlawed War. You can check out David Swanson's writing at davidswanson.org. There's lots of great information there. Use it as a resource to educate yourself. I know that I do. Again, David, thank you so much for being on the show. We do appreciate it. When we come back, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward is with us. She is running for an appointment to Suzanne Bonamici's vacated seat. Of course, Suzanne Bonamici running against Rob Cornelius for House District 1 in Beaverton. When we come back, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward is going to be here. Stay with us. We'll be right back.